Good afternoon. The time is 3 o'clock and you're tuned to KTOO News. This is a Juno afternoon for Tuesday, October 8th. My name is Martha Moore. On today's program, we'll talk with Aaron and Hig about their latest adventures. We'll get a preview of Wednesday's Mudrooms presentation, and we'll talk with members of the JDHS Student Council about their participation in the Alaska Association of Student Governments Conference. That, Writer's Almanac, Bird Note, music, and more. The forecast today is calling for a strong wind from this evening through early Wednesday morning. Today, rain, highs around 46. Tonight, rain, heavy at times, lows around 44. Tomorrow, rain, highs around 49.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. On Monday, protests took place across Canada and some in the U.S. on the 250th anniversary of the signing of a British proclamation. As Dan Karpinchuk reports, those involved in the Idle No More movement used the day to draw attention to various issues.
In Victoria, British Columbia, people gathered outside the province's legislative buildings to show their support in the fight against climate change. They focused on what they called Canada's moves to expand the energy industry at the expense of the climate. Some protesters carried a long black pipeline mock-up that stretched across the building's front steps. Placards carried the slogan, "Pipelines, Gateway to Climate Disaster." Others say they are using the day to bring in a new era of reconciliation of what they describe as Canada's shameful colonial history and to set right centuries of neglect and abuse of First Nations. One Native leader, Jean Bocage, says it was still a significant day for all Canadians.
That was the first actual written document in common law that identifies First Nations as nations. Only nations can sign treaties. We're all treaty people.
The 1763 proclamation set rules for European settlement in North America, recognized First Nations land rights, and laid out the groundwork for the treaty process. For National Native News, I'm Dan Karpinchuk.
Alaska Native tribal governments are keeping their doors open during the federal government shutdown. KMBA's Jocelyn Estes reports.
Native American tribes rely on federal dollars for everything from roads and disaster relief to housing and health services. Gloria O'Neill is president and CEO of Cook Inlet Tribal Council in South Central Alaska. She says CITC's general assistance program is underfunded and normally runs out of money halfway into the fiscal year. But she says the infusion that normally comes at the start of the new fiscal year on October 1st is missing.
That program is funded by the Bureau of Indian Affairs, and we have not received our funding for general assistance this year.
O'Neill says CITC is using other aid programs to help people eligible for general assistance, and she says it's careful to keep scholarship money going out the door.
Our kids are in school, and they need to see that money.
O'Neill says funding to tribes should not be considered discretionary because it's used to meet actual need and because it's based on promises the federal government made in treaties. Reporting in Anchorage, I'm Jocelyn Estes.
The Oneida Indian Nation held a symposium Monday in Washington, D.C. as part of its Change the Mascot effort. The New York tribe has launched the campaign, which includes radio ads against the name of the Washington Redskins. Monday's event was held as the NFL team met for its fall gathering in D.C. Oneida Representative Ray Halberter says the name is a racial slur. The meeting was held days after President Obama weighed in on the name change, saying in an interview, if he was owner, he'd think about changing it. Dan Snyder, owner of the team, has publicly stated he will never change the name. The Washington Post reports a meeting with the tribe and the NFL is scheduled for next month. The tribe is urging the NFL to take a stand against the name. the Boston Celtics opened its preseason game Monday against the Toronto Raptors. An Alaska Native man was signed as a free agent and has been training with the team. Damon Bellhalter is from Heidelberg, Alaska. The forward averaged 15.5 points per game at Oral Roberts University. According to the Celtics, terms of deals were not disclosed. The team's 8-game preseason ends October 23rd as Bellhalter waits for word on a position. During this week in 2009, the U.S. Senate passed a resolution to offer an apology from the United States government to American Indians. The resolution was included in the Defense Appropriations Bill and did not serve as a settlement or resolve challenges facing Native people. President Obama later signed the spending bill into law. This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kawanic Broadcast Corporation, with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation. Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
This is KTOO-FM. You are listening to a Juno Afternoon, and I'm pleased to have in the studio with me Eric McKittrick and Brentwood Higman, also known as Hig. Aaron is the author of A Long Trek Home, the story of the couple's 4,000-mile trip by foot, pack raft, and ski from Seattle to the tip of Alaska Peninsula, which is also the subject of the award-winning film titled Journey on the Wild Coast. Aaron's new book is titled Small Feet, Big Land, Adventure, Home, and Family on the Edge of Alaska. And this book describes their expeditions exploring Alaska's coastline with their two young children in tow. Welcome, Aaron and Hig.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
And I also have in the studio Greg Chaney. He directed the documentary, which was Journey on the Wild Coast, and he's also has put together a new documentary that presents this the new expedition that they did on the Malaspina Glacier. And I want to just go ahead and mention that there will be a slideshow of that. It's a sneak preview of that documentary, and it's called Life on Ice. It's on Thursday at 7 o'clock at Centennial Hall. That's Thursday night at 7 o'clock. And what does that documentary contain?
Well, thank you. First of all, it's great to be here, and really appreciate having us on the show. The documentary is based on Hig and Aaron's footage and my footage when I went out and joined them for the last roughly week of their trip out on the Malaspina Glacier. And what I did was I tried to corral all that footage and put it into some kind of a coherent narrative, and it jumps around a little bit, but it gives you the idea, kind of the sights and sounds and experiences that Hig and Aaron and their family, Latuya and Katmai, had, and then that'll lead into Aaron's book presentation, which is more of what they were thinking, I believe, and kind of what this experience.
Yeah, and then so we'll be doing, after that 15-minute film, a roughly 45-minute slideshow presentation with some readings from the book. And Hearthside Books is sponsoring this.
Okay, and Latuya and Katmai are?
Our kids.
Your children. And so for our listeners who are not familiar with what you have done, could you just give us a little bit about your backgrounds and how it is that you adopted this trekking lifestyle? What motivated you or motivates you to do this?
I think, you know, both Aaron and I started from sort of different places, and we came together and ended up in this trekking habit. I had spent a lot of time in the wilderness and you know, developing sort of a comfort in the Alaska wilderness, but I never really had sort of a big vision as far as ambitious projects, and that's really what Aaron brought in.
Yeah, I thought, okay, well, you want to go do a hike in Alaska, why don't we go do a 2-month hike in Alaska or a year-long hike? And we kind of got into this pattern where I think we've probably walked somewhere around 8,000 miles in the state over the past decade or so.
That's quite a pattern. Do you see this pattern continuing?
Oh yeah.
Yeah, definitely.
Pretty much hooked.
Yeah, we're already thinking about next plans.
So, what is it you love about trekking?
Well, it's a number of things. You know, I think that there's this basic. I mean, anyone who's been out on a hike and enjoyed it, you know, there's some basic things you love. I think everyone loves about being out in the wilderness, the views you see and stuff. And sometimes we get to see those to a greater extent. We see just amazing places. But there are a bunch of other things that come in. One of the things that drives me the most is actually the sort of the sense of exploration and of learning that we get out of these trips, the, you know, sense of not knowing what's coming and being able to, you know, go through that transition where we come out with something new, I guess.
Yeah, I think that we started thinking, oh, this is just recreation, and it is still recreation. We enjoy it, but the more we go out and do these things, the more we're able to learn along the way. And so that learning and sharing what we've seen has become a big part of what we do.
So, yeah, let me ask you about that. I know in this new book, your narration is based on some reoccurring themes. And could you tell us about some of these themes and how they tie in with your travels?
Well, one theme that comes through this book especially is climate change. It's something that kind of became part of our Alaska trips from the beginning, not because we intended that, but because you really can't avoid it. You start hiking off and into, well, where there used to be glaciers, and you just start seeing that. And so we were both up in the Northwest Arctic, which is an area that's very rapidly changing and eroding due to climate change, and then again on Malaspina Glacier here in Southeast, likewise.
Yeah, I think it goes beyond just that melting glaciers. You know, you have a lot of changes that are happening, and they're really obvious in the natural world, whereas in the realm of thermostats and hard structures, it's not so apparent.
So you describe the little picture of, you know, the area you're moving through and continually relating it to the big picture, and I think that's through your research. What does the research add to your writing?
Well, I think we both, before we were adventurers, we were both actually trained as scientists. So I have a master's degree in molecular biology, and Hig has a PhD in geology. And so we very much sort of saw and thought about the world through that scientific lens. And so we were able to combine that in this book and in some of our other work with the on-the-ground narrative.
I think that it both, you know, it's not just in the book, it's also in the experience that, you know, we find there's all these amazing things you can learn by, you know, reading, by Googling different topics and stuff. And that is one whole facet, and I think it's tremendously valuable. I love doing it. And then we go out into the wilderness kind of reflecting on this, and we always find we learn new things and we kind of change our perspective. And I think that the pairing of those two ways of knowing and ways of learning is very powerful.
And it's not just from the wilderness. We also learn from people, too. Our journeys through the state take us through many remote communities and just people we meet along the way, and their perspectives are an important part of the story, too.
So your style, Erin, it kind of reminds me of Annie Dillard. I don't know if you're familiar with her.
A little, yeah.
Yeah, Pilgrim at Tinker Creek. And in the way that you notice everything, everything's connected. And there's sort of a philosophical thread through your narrative, and there's an educational component. And I think it's a great style. It works really well. It's easy to read. It's easy to learn that way. I guess my question is, how do you recall it all? I mean, I know you take a journal, you keep a journal, but still, I mean, how do you get back into that situation?
Well, the journal really is the key. And, you know, you kind of think a journal, you know, if you read some of the old trapper's ones and think, oh, it's like, this is what the weather was today and this is how many fox I caught. But when I journal, I usually spend at least an hour every night writing, and I write everything. I end up with quite a large stack of write-in-the-rain paper and a lot of notes. And then reading through that and then looking through the pictures as well, you can get back into that moment that day. And otherwise, I couldn't do it.
And I'd like to jump in and say I actually read Erin's unabridged journal from both journeys, and it's really impressive because she's got so much material there, but it's also it is easy to find yourself back in that place. And since I wasn't on the first trip at all, it was very helpful for me when I was watching their footage. A lot of it didn't make any sense to me until I read her journal entries, and then I was able to put it together with her narrative and those images, and then it told a really compelling story. So, I have a lot of respect for someone who can sit down and after a long day in the freezing cold and actually write something coherent, because usually at the end of the day I'm ready to go to sleep.
Erin's quite religious about it, actually. I've seen her, you know, sit down and start writing, and my eyes are closing. It's been something, especially on days when things don't go well, and it's been really difficult. Those are important days to record what happens. And she's.
I imagine throughout the day these thoughts are going through your mind. You're thinking, I got to get this down.
Yeah, and I think, you know, I've trained myself pretty well to try to remember things and conversations and that sort of thing, just for one day. You know, one day I can hold it in my head, and then I have to write it all down.
How did trekking with two small children change things for the two of you?
We covered fewer miles in a day, but otherwise not as much as I feared it would before we had kids.
I mean, there's a lot of ways it really added to it. I mean, it expanded kind of what we were doing, and I think the sort of trick, the challenge there is that if you go out there and you say, well, I want to do this thing and I've got kids, how do I drag them through this? It's not going to go well. You know, it's how do you come up with something? How do you come up with an adventure that really fits, with being a family? You know, not with you and some kids. It's like what is a family adventure? And that's been what we've been trying to achieve. How do we, come up with ideas that fit that idea, that concept?
And it really works remarkably well. I think that, you think that kids are actually, oh, your kids must be really tough, or how do they handle the weather or whatever. Kids are much tougher than adults. They don't really know that they're supposed to dislike rain. They don't really know that they're, supposed to prefer sleeping indoors. They don't know any of those things. They're just outside playing, having a great time. And one of the big changes is that it slowed us down, and that we don't cover as much distance. We have to carry more stuff, but I kind of like being slower. The noticing was a big part of what we did already, and the slower you go, the more you notice.
And you do mention a couple times in the book that for kids, the criteria for their enjoyment for life is being with mom and dad like 24/7.
Especially when they're very small, yes.
So they get much more out of it than maybe people think. It seems like a lot of work, actually, taking kids along. And I think you alluded to this, but it's interesting when you think about the Alaska Native people, and some of whom were nomadic until into the 1950s, and they were used to traveling with their families over great distances.
Yeah, I think that, we encounter people who look at what we do and say, they think that it's not only difficult, but it's virtually impossible. But if you look back just a short time, this was really commonplace, most of what we're doing. And we have a number of tools that make it easier. It is absolutely possible.
We've just forgotten that it was normal. People think what we do is abnormal, but really what we do is very normal, and we've just forgotten it over the past 100 years or so.
Is there a point at which, you're done preparing, you're done planning, and you get out there and you sort of have a sense of relief, and then it's just problem solving?
Definitely. Actually, the expedition planning is always one of the most stressful parts, and I do it because it's necessary, but I don't like it. And, it's just there's more and more, and you have to do all of this stuff. But then once you're out there, well, whatever you've done, and then you're just out there, and it's like, okay, I'm here. I've got this much food. I've got this stuff in my backpack, and this is where I'm going. And it's just remarkably more simple.
It's a very dramatic transition.
So, taking risks is inherent in what you are doing, and especially in the wilderness, and especially with two small children. How do you weigh the risks against the benefits, and how do you prepare for the worst?
Well, you know, I think taking risks is inherent in everyone's lives, and you know, and we do think very seriously about it. One of the things that I kind of try to force myself. It's easy to get in this mode where you're like, oh, you know, this is what I want to do, so I'm going to try to tell myself a story where I say that the risks aren't there. And I try not to do that. I try to say, well, I think this might be a good idea. Let's look at those risks. You know, what are the stories, those terrible stories you don't even want to tell yourself? You know, what could happen, and how do we really target those and reduce those risks? So it's risk mitigation in that way, and there is a sense of weighing costs and benefits, but you know, I think it's more about that kind of a sense of what kind of risk is reasonable and how you might best mitigate those risks.
And I don't think it's any more risky than a lot of what we do every day. It's just less familiar to most people. Like, I still think even on our expeditions, probably one of the most risky things we ever do is get on a little plane to get to or from where we're going to start walking. And likewise, you know, people get in cars every day, and you think about that risk and you mitigate it with things like car seats. And for us, it's the same. We might be somewhere camping where there is a fair amount of bear activity, so we mitigate that by, you know, putting food in odor-proof bags, trying to find a campsite a little out of the main traffic zone, and carrying a small electric fence. And I don't think there's any fundamental difference between that and, okay, I'm going to go in this highway, and I'm going to use a seatbelt and a car seat.
Well, or another one would be, I'm going to live next to the highway with a increased exposure to particulates that have a cancer risk down the road. Well, now, when we're out in the field, we're thinking about, you know, what can we do to reduce bear risk? That would be more analogous to the highway. And we are also thinking about how do we, you know, we cook on fires. Smoke is a cancer hazard. You know, how do we reduce our exposure to smoke? I mean, we, you know, these are the same kind of reasoning that I think everyone does, and we're just in a kind of different environment.
So, Greg, you joined them the last week of 2 months on the Malaspina Glacier. Were they a well-oiled machine by then?
That's an interesting, well-buttered machine. They have a lot of butter in their diet, so that was good. The main thing about my experience of coming in, you know, I've done a lot of wilderness trips myself, but not these sort of epic journeys. And when I came in, I felt like it was very much like meeting up with a native family that had lived out in the wilderness. You know, it wasn't like meeting a bunch of rough, you know, testosterone-laden guys trying to, you know, out there to prove something. It was just like, oh, there's some kids here and a little family situation. It was very comfortable. So that was really unique, but it was also very, very natural and comfortable. And I would like to say, too, that I didn't want to be involved in something that was going to put kids at risk. But as I looked at the situation, I think that in a lot of ways it's actually safer than what we, Americans are accustomed to. A lot of people die on highways every day, but we just say, well, of course, that happens. And in this case, there were no cars. The only thing that we had to really worry about were bears, and we had bear spray and a lot of adults around, and they did mention the electric fence. And so I didn't feel like we were in that much danger, and certainly not the kids. The one thing the kids had is they had access to their parents 24/7, maybe a little too much for their parents' sake, but there are no babysitters out there. But they weren't going to daycare. They were with their kids and their parents, and I felt like that was probably the most organic part of the whole thing, was just, you know, the continuity of the family unit.
So I'm going to ask you, Aaron, to read something out of the book. It's a passage I picked, kind of as an answer to what it is you're trying to do with this writing.
Sure. On any journey, we learn about ourselves and so much more, 100 more important things about the world beyond our own emotions. It was a revelation that grew to become our mission. Go out and see, touch, smell, talk to people, take pictures, and write everything down. Come back and share it, seeking to touch on crucial and sometimes forgotten issues by sharing those stories, those facts, and our many hours of background research with the peculiar twist of perspective that comes from being at the ground truth of things.
Thank you. What is it you want to try to do with these books, and what are you trying to give the reader?
I think that I like trying to make people think. I think it would be much easier in a way to say, oh, okay, this is my, you know, soapbox, this is my stance, I want everybody to think this or do that, and it would be an easier soundbite, but it would be kind of contrary to the whole point of going out and learning things in the world. I don't want to, you know, tell people what they should be doing or thinking, but I just want to tell our story and weave through it some things that I think people should think about.
Tell us about ground truth trekking.
Well, this is somewhat the same concept we're talking about. I mean, you know, over the years we've found that we go out into the wilderness and we learn so much, and that we seek through ground, you know, through our, so Ground Truth Trekking is a 501c nonprofit. It's a nonprofit that Aaron and I formed, and we use that as a vehicle for communication and we have a website that has a lot of articles on a myriad of different issues, especially around mining in Alaska.
And some beautiful pictures, I might add.
Tons of pictures and stories about some of our journeys. And I think for me, one of the ways I think about this endeavor, I guess, that it covers some of what Aaron's doing with her books and the nonprofit is, you know, that I think that there are a lot of important choices that we all make that affect the future, you know, that affect where we're going, in the big picture. And I have some ideas about those, but there's every reason to think I might be just as wrong as everyone else. Like there's nothing special about my perspective. But what I try to share is what are the sort of the basic facts that lead to the decisions that I've made, and hopefully maybe someone else would go to a different decision. But if they, I feel like those facts are real, and they're something that we can all agree on, and that if we're all, you know, thinking about, you know, what's really out there, that we're more likely to make good choices.
What are you planning to do next?
Well, we kind of have this every couple years pattern we've been developing. So we just actually went out for 3.5 months this spring and summer, and we walked 800 miles around Cook Inlet with the kids. And so we're probably going to spend the next year doing not nothing, but a lot of little smaller trips closer to our home in Soldovia. And then after that, we have this vague plan. We met up with some folks that were sailing around the world and climbing all of the highest peaks by human power. They had 4 children on their expedition that's just been going since 2000, and they invited us, hey, come hitch a ride on our sailboat, and we're going around the Northwest Passage. We can drop you off to do a trip. So that might be our next plan.
It's pretty open-ended right now, but it sounds pretty cool.
How old are your children now?
4.5 and 2.5.
And you've already taken the trip around the Cook
Inlet,
and what will be produced as a result of that?
Well, I've got another great big stack of notes, and hopefully I can turn them into an engaging story. I definitely have plans for another book, but I haven't, you know, it's not that far along yet.
So I've been talking to Aaron McKittrick and Hig Higman, and also Greg Cheney. Just to remind you again, Thursday night at Centennial Hall at 7 o'clock, Life on Ice. It's going to be a sneak preview of Greg's documentary that describes, what does it describe again?
It's the journey that Hig and Aaron and their children took on the Malaspina Glacier.
On the Malaspina Glacier.
And
yeah,
that is also a part of the book, Small Feet, Big Land, which will be the other half of that presentation.
Okay.
And it's free.
Yes,
and
it is free.
And anything else you plan to do while you're in town?
Yeah, we're actually going to be talking to a couple of the classes at the university in the next couple days and just visiting with friends we have here in town.
And we have an engagement with 360 North, too, which I'm not sure exactly what that will be in detail, but something.
And you, Aaron, will be giving some short excerpts from your book as well on Thursday night?
Yeah, so the presentation we usually do involves, there's a lot of pretty pictures, and then along with it, both Hig and I talk about our journeys and the book, and then I do several short readings.
Great. Well, I want to thank you all for coming in. And I enjoyed very much reading your book and watching the documentary, and I encourage people to come out and see your pictures.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Tuesday, the 8th of October, 2013. It was on this day, 1956, the Yankees pitcher Don Larsen pitched a perfect game in the World Series, faced 27 batters, not one made it to first base. It is still the only perfect World Series game in history, one of only 20 perfect games in baseball history. According to Larsen, he didn't even know he would be pitching until he got to the ballpark. He'd had a disastrous game in Game 2 against the Dodgers, lasted only 2 innings, allowed 4 runs on 4 walks. The Yankees had been up 6-0 when Larsen took the mound in Game 2, and they ended up losing 13-8. So he was astonished when he came to the ballpark for Game 5 to find that the manager had tucked a baseball in his spikes. It's the birthday of the poet and author Blake Morrison, born in Skipton, North Yorkshire, England, 1950, author of the memoir And When Did You Last See Your Father? The science fiction author Frank Herbert, Tacoma, Washington, 1920, best known for his masterpiece Dune, which was rejected by 20 publishers before it was finally brought out by Chilton, a publisher who had been best known for publishing auto repair manuals. It's the birthday of the historian of the sinking of the Titanic, Walter Lord, 1917, in Baltimore. The book was A Night to Remember. It was a bestseller when it came out in 1955. And the novelist and short story writer Brett Lott, 1958, in Los Angeles, author of 7 novels, including Ancient Highway, and a couple of memoirs, Fathers, Sons, and Brothers, and Before We Get Started, a practical memoir of the writer's life. Here's a poem for today by Wesley McNair, The Rules of the New Car. After I got married and became the stepfather of two children, just before we had two more, I bought it, the bright blue sorrowful car that slowly turned to scratches and the flat black spots of gum in the seats and stains impossible to remove from the floor mats. "Never again," I said, as our kids, four of them by now, climbed into the new car. "This time there will be rules." The first to go was the rule I made for myself about cleaning it once a week. "Though why," I shouted at the kids in the rearview mirror, "should I have to clean it if they would just remember to fold their hands?" 3 years later, it was the same car I had before, except for the dent my wife put in the grill when, ignoring the regulation about snacks, she reached for a bag of chips on her way home from work and hit a tow truck. Oh, the ache I felt for the broken rules and the beautiful car that had been lost, and the car that we now had on soft shocks in the driveway, still unpaid for. Then, one day, for no particular reason, except that the car was loaded down with wood for the fireplace at my in-laws' camp, and groceries and sheets and clothes for the week, my wife in the passenger seat, the dog lightly panting beside the kids in the back, all innocent anticipation, waiting for me to join them, I opened the door to my life. A poem by Wesley McNair, The Rules of the New Car, from Lovers of the Lost, New and Selected Poems, published by David R. Godin, and used by permission here on The Writer's Almanac, supported by Lumosity. Lumosity.com's daily online workouts are designed to improve memory and attention and are dedicated to helping people feel sharper, think faster, and remember more. More at Lumosity.com. And by LendingTree, where you can fill out one form and receive up to 5 loan offers at trylendingtree.com, NMLS1136. Produced by Joy Biles, with assistance by Teresa Burgess. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
You are tuned to KTOO. This is a Juno afternoon, and I have in the studio with me Alita Buss and Mark Wheeler. Hi, and welcome.
Hey, Martha.
Hey, Martha.
And they are here to talk about mudrooms. And just want to mention, before we get started, mudrooms is tomorrow night at 7 p.m. at McFeeder's Hall.
Nope.
Oh, my
gosh. Stop right there. We changed locations. We outgrew our former digs, and we are now at the Northern Light United Church in the flats.
All right. I just made an assumption here. So, so tomorrow night, 7 p.m. at the Northern Lights Church.
That's right.
And so what is Mudrooms?
Mudrooms is a community storytelling event where 7 speakers each tell a 7-minute personal story based around a theme.
And not professional storytellers. These are just everyday folks you see on the street, maybe your neighbor, maybe some guy that you see walking down the street every day and say hi to.
Maybe you.
Maybe you can come. It's just everyday people telling everyday stories about everyday lives and really a way to build this community one story at a time.
And what is tomorrow night's theme?
It's coming home.
And the theme, I assume, is sort of just open to interpretation by the speaker.
That's right. We have some people who adhere strictly to the theme and some who twist and bend and only maybe loosely follow the theme.
And the audience is trying to connect it up. And
yeah. But it's a way to, you know, maybe people think about a story that might fit or, just kind of tie the show together. But it's not too restrictive.
Can you tell us who tomorrow night's speakers are?
Yeah, they're Michael Cohen, Michelle and Jim Hale, Rich Forst is coming over from Sitka.
Now, wait, are Michelle and Jim telling the story together or separately?
They're a married couple, but they're each telling a story separately.
Each telling a story, cool.
Yeah. Jerry Smetzer and Ryan Conroe.
Okay, great. So what makes a good storyteller?
It, You know, I think it's helpful for people to rehearse their stories ahead of time and not just try to wing it. Though some people do wing it well, but I think what people really like is genuineness. So, you know, some people like to be funny, some people like to pull the heartstrings, but I think most important is to be genuine. Tell a story that really tells something about yourself, not who you want to project yourself to be, but who you really are. And that's something I think everybody connects to when they see that person kind of burying themselves on stage. But it can also be something lighthearted or just something, you know, that connects you to your neighbors.
So for many people, public speaking is their greatest fear. So why would someone choose to do this?
It is a challenge for some people. And what's, I think, an attractive thing about mudrooms is that it is people who are amateurs. I mean, we have a few people who are on stage who are performers, like Ryan Conroe just had his performance arts piece for Friday, you know, Friday, and he's used to being in front of an audience. But I think it's charming when you get somebody who's not used to that and they're just sharing. It is a fairly large audience. You know, we've had an audience between 100 and 150, and that's why we're moving into the Northern Light space. But
I assume the audience is polite and nurturing.
Oh, yeah, they're very forgiving. I mean, it's not like you're being judged or anything, or there's not people holding up scorecards. It's just people who want to come out and hear about the people in their community. And some people, you know, are scared of public speaking and do this because they want to get over their fear, you know. But we're not really suggesting that. But if you know, we take anybody who wants to come. We don't ask for any kind of audition or anything. It's just come on and tell your story. And we have some time limits just to keep things rolling. We have a little few calls. We blow a deer call at 6 minutes. Is that right?
At five, a 5 minute warning.
And then we have a moose call now?
Yeah.
A moose call at 7 minutes. So we try to keep the program. And we have music every show to feature some local artists. Who's playing?
It's Daniel Kirkwood is going to be our musician tomorrow night.
Oh,
and
good.
If you haven't heard him, he's great. He plays the guitar, and that should be a nice way to get the atmosphere set in the beginning, and then he'll play at a 20-minute intermission that we have between the fourth and fifth storytellers.
So besides the 7-minute limit, are there any other rules?
Well, we have a donation. We ask you to make a donation if you come, and it's a $7 donation, and all the money goes straight to charity. We're not a nonprofit. We're just a group of people. So we take the money and pass it through to a nonprofit that can benefit. So the first half of the season will benefit Discovery Southeast,
okay.
And the second half of the season will benefit Big Brothers Big Sisters here in Juneau.
Okay. So if someone wants to be a mudroom speaker, how do they do that?
They can go to our website, which is mudrooms.org, and sign up. So there's a listing of all of our events for this season. We are going to run through May, and we alternate between the second Wednesday and Tuesday, I think. Don't quote me on that. It's all on the website for the date and then the themes also. So I think next month, November, we have Scars, and that's on a Tuesday. And we have openings still for speakers then, and in December the theme is awkward, and I know that all of you out there have an awkward time or an embarrassing moment that you want to tell.
Isn't it awkward? Wait, one more thing. We also have, if you go online, you can hear all the past speakers. Record, thanks to KTOO, who loans us a recording device. We record and archive all the speakers online, and then also, thanks to KTO, you can hear those folks 1 month, every month we play them on a Monday night at 7 just based on availability. So you can hear everybody on the radio, and sometimes in Juneau afternoon you guys also play excerpts of speakers.
So when somebody gets online, do they fill out some sort of a application?
Yeah, there's a little form you can fill in. Or we have an email. We have an email address also that they email to say, so that we can check to make sure there's space for them.
Or you can just contact any of the board members if you know any of us, myself, Alita, Amanda Compton,
Rich Moniak,
Clint Farr,
Tom Cosgrove, Quinn White. He's a high schooler at JDHS. He's a junior.
And then we have a teacher now, right?
Oh, yeah, Pat Roach. He's at Thunder Mountain. He is a culinary teacher out there. So if you know any of these people, you can just approach them and talk to them a little bit about it.
Okay, great. I'm speaking with Alita Buss and Mark Wheeler about mudrooms, and this is happening at Northern Lights Church downtown here in the Flats, and it's at tomorrow night at 7 p.m., seven speakers, $7, seven...
Minutes each.
Minutes each.
And are we going to have daycare?
No, but that's not a bad idea.
We're trying to figure that out, to have daycare provided for parents to come and attend. You're welcome to bring your children. It's a family-friendly event, but sometimes folks might want to not bring their kids, so we're just trying to figure out how to have some daycare available during the show, but it's not quite ready yet.
It's a big enough venue that really everybody can come. And
yeah. Yeah,
we have won't have to turn anyone away.
We have the chapel, and then there's the fellowship hall in the back. We could open up. We have a big crowd, so we should have plenty of room. So come on down. There's parking. You know, right there's a parking lot, and folks should be able to find a place to park and come on out and hear your neighbors. And it's just a wonderful event. It just grows and grows. And I think if you, I think anybody would like it, really. It's a great event.
Okay.
And we have treats and coffee there for purchase, too. That also goes to the charity.
And get to know something about your fellow Junoites that you might not normally know.
That's right. And these are stories that we all share, right? I mean, that's something, you know, we have these divides in our community, Democrat, Republican, Valley, town. But when you hear these stories, you realize that we're all the same. We share these stories. We all are here for many of the same reasons.
Thanks, Mark and Alita, for coming in.
Thanks, Martha.
Thank you, Martha.
Tell me a story of days gone by. I want to leave this life of mine. Nothing but sorrow and pain I find. Tell me a story of days gone by. Tell me of princes, jesters, and kings, town fools, crown jewels, scepters and rings, goodies and little girls lost in the woods. Tell me of axes.
KTOO, and this is a Juno afternoon. I'm in the studio with Tori Talley. She is a student at JDHS. Hi, Tori.
Hi.
It's great to have you come in and talk about what she's going to talk about is the Statewide Alaska Association of Student Governments, and they're having a conference October 17th through the 19th. That's not this weekend, but the weekend after?
Yes.
And tell us something about tell us about this conference.
So the conference is held twice a year in different places in Alaska, and it has about 300 to 400 high school student government peer leaders and everything that come and learn about leadership for a couple days.
And what you're on the student council?
Yes, I am.
And are you an officer? Or who gets to be on the student council?
You get elected for the school student council. You get elected by your peers, depending on your class. And I'm on the ASB board as the parliamentarian, so we're elected by the whole student body.
And so each class has a representative?
Each class has a student council of 5 members.
And then there are officers?
Yes. So each class has a president, a vice president, a secretary and treasurer, well, actually a representative, 2 student representatives and 1 site council representative, and then e-board has a parliamentarian, secretary, treasurer, president, and a vice president.
So this Association of Student Governments, and that's, I'm sure when I went to school, we didn't have that. So what is that, the mission of that organization?
I believe the mission is to bring student voice and leadership throughout the state of Alaska. They have their own e-board, which is about 15 different members, and they meet 4 times a year, including the 2 conferences that are hosted for all students. And one big thing they've been working on is suicide prevention, so it's just bringing students into Alaska and making sure they can lead and have a voice.
And what's the conference's theme?
Our theme this year is 8 Stars of Leadership because it is on Alaska Day. So it's Spend Alaska Day in Alaska's capitals with Alaska's leader.
So what will you be doing all day at this conference?
We have multiple different things. One of the main things we do is GAs, General Assemblies, where all the student population gets together and discusses resolutions, which are really pieces of paper that students have compiled facts and information on something they would like to change. It can be something from having a student DJ at their dance all the way to one of the U.S. Senate, one of the state Senate bills for cognitive training. So,
wow, that's interesting. So the kinds of things that you work on to change or to have input on,
mm-hmm.
they could be anywhere from in your school to
mm-hmm.
statewide.
Yes, exactly. That's so cool.
Great. And will you be doing anything for fun, or is it all work?
Yes. So we actually do pods and workshops, which are different things where the students get to go out and learn new things, or they get to go out and I think one of our pods is going to be nail painting, and it's just stuff like that. We also are having a dance, so there's always a dance, so the students will have a couple hours just to have fun. And we've hired a motivational speaker from the East Coast, and her name is Amy Gallimore, and so she'll be coming and giving a speech to our students.
So how many high schools are represented?
This year, coming to our conference, there will be about 40 high schools.
And how many conferences do you generally have each year?
There are 2 main conferences each year, one in the fall and one in the spring.
So, let's see. So the conference here in Juneau, where will it be exactly located?
It's all going to be in our high school, in the Juneau Douglas High School. It's really actually a rare event because it's the only student organization high school thing where the students are housed in the high school as well. So they're going to be there all day, all night, and we have different pods where they're going places. So the Juneau Empire students will be going there as well as to different UAS pods, but everything is going to be inside our school.
And how do they pay for their travels here?
Most students, that's just in their student council budget, or they have to chip in. Also, OSOG does offer scholarships of up to 50% if the students meet certain criteria, such as holding a suicide prevention activity in their school and doing community service. So it's just a way to get the students more involved in their community, and then they get part of their fee paid for.
Has this been a lot of work for you, putting this conference on?
Yes, it's a lot of work. It's a lot of work for not only me, but my council and our advisor, Mr. Main.
How long have you been working on this?
We started working on it in about May is when we started working on it, but really it's been the past month or two that we've really been in drive and going at it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So I've got Tori Talley here in the studio with me. She's on the student government at JDHS, and she's been speaking to me with me about the Statewide Alaska Association of Student Governments Conference, and it's not this weekend, but the weekend mm-hmm. after, and I wish you a lot of luck on that.
Thank you so much.
Okay, thanks for coming in.
Tell me a story of days gone by. I want to leave this life of mine. Nothing but sorrow and pain.
This is Bird Note. After breeding in Alaska, some Swainson's thrushes migrate all the way across Canada to the east coast and then turn south to Ecuador. Others, breeding not far away, migrate directly down the Pacific coast. So, some are traveling twice the distance to get to the same destination. Why? Dr. Mike Webster of the Cornell Lab of Ornithology explains.
I think the reason is that the way natural selection works, the way evolution works, is that new adaptations are built on old adaptations. And so if you think about those birds 17,000 years ago, as the polar ice caps, the glacial ice caps receded, they just inched their way and moved their breeding grounds further and further north and a little bit to the west. They still continued to have programmed in them genetically this route that they used that their ancestors used, and that stuck with them as they moved further and further to the northwest. So that's the sort of thing that we see today in all sorts of other adaptations. New traits, new adaptations are built on old traits.
So, even though receding ice allowed the birds to colonize new breeding territory, when it came time to migrate in the fall, genetic coding compelled some of them to follow old ancestral routes south. But genetic variation allowed others to pioneer new routes. You can find more about the migratory divide of the Swainson's thrush at our website, birdnote.org.
And that's it for Juno Afternoon for today. Thanks for joining me. Thanks to all the guests for coming in today. And to listen to any of today's interviews or any other Juno Afternoon programs, visit the KTOO.org website under Local Programs and Juno Afternoon. Please join us tomorrow at 3 for Juno Afternoon. Our host will be Joan Pardis. Frank Capassi from the Juno Douglas Little Theater will be here to highlight Saturday's director's workshop. Sally Smith and Scarlett Adam will be here to put us in the mood for holiday music. We'll learn how you can learn your way around the Affordable Care Act with Crystal Borland. And we'll find out what's going on along Eagan Drive with guest John Garvey from Ever Electric. That, Writer's Almanac, Music and More, Wednesday at 3 on KTOO-FM. The weather is strong wind from this evening through early Wednesday morning. Tonight, rain heavy at times, lows around 42. Wednesday, rain showers, highs around 49, and pretty much rain the rest of the week. This is KTOO Juno. We broadcast on translators K276FAF in the Mendenhall Valley and Auk Bay, K269AO in Lemon and Schweitzer Creek, K201AM in Gustavus, K220BT in Hoonah and K210AS in Excursion Inlet and Icy Strait. In Juneau, KTOO is on GCI Cable and is digital channel 871. We are also online at ktoo.org. Support for national programming on KTOO comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and listeners like you. Behind me is Tchaikovsky, and coming up this weekend at 8 o'clock Saturday night is the Juno Symphony that will be playing Tchaikovsky, and also at 3 o'clock on Sunday afternoon. Please stay tuned for All Things Considered.
Something went wrong, and it just went to a page with all kinds of HTML stuff.
Technical trouble plaguing the rollout of the Affordable Care Act.
Today is Tuesday, October 8th, and this is All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Melissa Block.
And I'm Robert Siegel. Coming up, problems with the software for the Federal Health Insurance Exchange.
And what's made some state exchanges work more smoothly, for example, Kentucky. It has fewer bells and whistles than the federal site and some of the other states. And so they were able to really focus in on the quality and make sure that the site was running well and test it thoroughly.
Also, scientists study the aftermath of the Colorado flood.
And how about that new $100 bill?
I like it.
It looks like...